Well, thanks, Chris, for organizing the symposium and all the others in soil mineralogy for doing this, and it's great that you're all hanging in there till the bitter end. And I'm going to talk about something a little bit different than what the other speakers have talked about. We're focusing on agricultural processes. They've been alluded to a little bit earlier. Peter Narby, who works in my lab, talked a little bit about it, and actually a lot of the stuff at the end of my talk he's already talked about, so I will not have to spend a lot of time talking about that. And just to also clarify some of the questions earlier about the work that we're doing for agricultural dust, it's not wind erosion that we're dealing with. And so the question about whether sand from saltation is creating wind erosion, clearly that's the case, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about disturbance like an off-road vehicle or tillage effects on producing dust. So just to clarify, it's not wind erosion that we're really dealing with. And always, you know, you stand on the shoulders of giants. And here are some of the giants that I've worked with, Julie Baker, Bob Lawson, Jeff Mitchell, Rebecca Bingo, whose name you heard, Nick Madden, and Peter Narby, who've been collaborating. We've been working on dust for about the last 15 or 20 years in one form or another. And so I am presenting a few vignettes, some dust vignettes that you can ruminate on, if you will. Just as background, in the San Joaquin Valley, which is just over the grapevine from here on the other side of the San Gabriel Mountains, during the end of the harvest season, most of the winds blow from north to south in that part of California, and any stuff that goes on in the valley from Redding to Sacramento in the valley gets blown to the southern part of the San Joaquin. So it's really a sink for air pollutants. And that San Joaquin Valley is administered as an air quality district by the California Air Resources Board. And it habitually, and not always, but routinely, is identified as a non-attainment area for particulate matter. Peter defined particulate matter, PM10, that's particles with aerodynamic diameters less than 10 microns, not necessarily physical diameters. And right now, the regulations written by the EPA and by the California Air Resources Board that deal with how much PM10 can be in the atmosphere for 24 hours or for an average annual basis, and also PM2.5. As Peter pointed out, and I think as Brenda's work deals with, you know, the PM2.5 is nastier, but PM10 can be nasty too. Some estimates from the Air Resources Board suggests that on an annual basis, averaged on a daily basis, about 1,800 tons per day of PM10 is emitted in the San Joaquin Valley. And not all of it comes from agriculture, thank goodness. A lot of it comes from diesels running up and down Highway 5, and comes from air, from fires in the winter. A relatively small part of it comes from cultivation practices, so a little bit less than 10%. And if you include some of that fugitive dust farmlands, which may include some wind erosion, it's about something on the order of 10% or maybe a little bit more that we're dealing with here in terms of the research that we're talking about now. So it's not going to manage that PM10, is not going to solve the problem in the San Joaquin, but, you know, we're trying to chip away at every piece that we can. Just to show you that, in general, there is a correlation between what goes on in the agricultural fields in California in the San Joaquin and when PM10 concentrations violate the air quality standards. This is the national air quality standard up here, the dotted line. The dashed line below is the state standard. The state standard is much more conservative than the national. And thank goodness our government in this case, I think, is protecting us by having more restrictive air quality standards in the state than the feds require. The point is that a lot of the agricultural activity at the end of harvest time comes here in the latter parts of October, November, December, and I'm trying to get my arrow to show here. There it is. Okay. These exceedances of the EPA air quality standards occur at the end of harvest season and during harvest season. This is when almonds are harvested, and this is when cotton fields are disked and bedded after harvest. So there's a lot of tillage activity that goes on at the end of the season here, and that's when a lot of the air quality standards are exceeded. The implication is that there's a connection between agricultural activities and the air quality non-attainment. The California Air Resources Board, as we say, the CARBs, so if you want to count your CARBs, you can use some of these numbers. The California Air Resources Board has compiled from a number of studies emission factors. In other words, what kinds of activities in agriculture produce how much dust. I just highlighted a few here in terms of land preparation, because most of the irrigated agriculture in California for annual crops is furrow irrigated, and we're moving away from that, but there's a lot of land planing that goes on so you can get water from one end of the row to the other. So there's soil material moved around all the time with laser levelers, and a huge amount of dust is produced by that land leveling and land planning process. So I emphasize that. In the harvest, the big culprit is almond harvest, and I'll talk a little bit about how that happens. As they say, well, I call them almonds, the almond farmers call them almonds, and they say when we harvest them, we shake the L out of them. So, but you'll see that almond harvest is among the dustiest of the operations agriculturally in California, and I'm going to highlight then some of the work that we've been done that focuses on land preparation and almond harvest, so you can figure out how those are related. And I know one thing to, as soil scientists, we're all in the room as soil scientists, note down at the bottom that the CARB emission factors do not take into consideration any variations in soil properties. All emit at the same rate, regardless of water content, texture, mineralogy. And I know that's just causing you to chomp at the bit. I hope so. Here's what land preparation looks like in a cotton field at the end of harvest. As soon as they harvest cotton, they disc it and they prep it. And so here's a land leveler that creates a heck of a lot of dust. And a lot of it's bigger than PM10, but a lot of it's in the PM10 range. Here's what almond harvest looks like in July, late July, August, and September. The nuts are here in a windrow, and they're picked up by a harvester, and then all the dust gets blown out in the exhaust fan out the side of the harvester. It creates huge plumes of dust in the orchard. So land preparation and almond harvest are the two dustiest agricultural operations in California agriculture. Okay, first of all, what's in the dust? Guess. Well, it's mostly soil particles. So during one of those times when we're measuring dust, there's the sampling tower at different elevations, and we have some of the improved samplers, impactor samplers, to get time resolved and size resolved, sizes of material. But we put the sampling tower downwind purposely to try to catch the dust. And this is, Julie talked about, this is a dust's eye view. This is what the eyes of dust look like. This is a scanning electron micrograph of what the dust particles look like, and of course they're not that color. Through the miracle of Photoshop, we cause the vermiculite to be kind of yellowish, the biotite to be bluish in the upper right-hand corner, smectite to be purple, and then a little tiny bit of hornblende is greenish there. And we were able to deduce what those compounds were by making microprobe measurements of the elemental composition of the grains and being able to figure out, not by X-ray diffraction, but by elemental composition, what's in the dust. And we compared this on two sides of the valley, the Coast Range side, which is mostly sedimentary, and the Sierran side, which is mostly granitic. And there's some differences in composition of the dust. That's not really the point here, but the point is that we're able to estimate the composition of the dust by elemental analysis, by microprobe analyses, and we partition then the chemical constituents to known or reasonably well-known chemical formulas. And we find out, not surprisingly, that the composition of the dust is similar to the mineralogy of the soil from whence it comes. And it's a good thing that is the case. That's not always the case, as we've seen from some of our global transport models. But locally, they match quite well. What is on the ground is in the dust. Okay, so the question is, what can we do from an agricultural point of view to reduce that dust? And I want to focus, first of all, on almond harvest. So here's an almond harvester coming toward you. The nuts have been shaken from the trees by a big tree shaker that grabbed the branches. Those nuts get all over the ground. They're then swept into windrows between the rows of the trees, which is also a rather dusty operation. But in the third operation, the actual harvest, a machine comes along and picks up the nuts and the hulls and the sticks and the mice and the beer cans and the cigarette butts and everything else that's in that windrow. And then there's a big fan at the end of the harvester that sucks all that material up. The low-density material gets blown out the fan. The nuts and hulls are just the right size that they don't fall through the machine, and all the other stuff falls to the bottom of the back to the orchard floor. So it's a dusty operation because a lot of soil material gets blown through the fan. And so what we wanted to do was compare, because the almond harvester manufacturers in California are part of the solution to the problem. A number of companies have developed modifications to their harvesters that use a slightly different process for picking up the nuts, and we wanted to compare how much dust is produced by the conventional harvesters versus the reduced dust harvesters, the modified. So we did some field experiments in an almond orchard. Here's what they look like. The conventional harvester this is where the nuts are picked up. I can't get my arrow back here. I'll show you here. This is where the nuts get picked up. They get put on a conveyor belt. Materials fall through a conveyor belt called a dirt chain. So all the soil material falls to the back onto the ground. The nuts are too big to fall through the dirt chain, and they go into the nut cart at the top end of the figure there. The modified almond harvester really just lengthens that conveyor belt and gives more opportunity for soil materials to fall through the dirt chain, and they put an eccentric ham on there so it kind of beats the conveyor belt. It shakes the conveyor belt to allow more of the soil material. It's a pretty simple concept. And the question was, does it make a difference in terms of how much dust is produced? Okay, so we had a not very sophisticated method. We pulled a trailer behind I think it was a Ford F-250. The model of truck is not important. And we pulled those samplers about two rows away from where the harvester was moving. So we didn't want to choke the filters. We have little plastic cassettes with Teflon filters, and we weigh the filters before and after. And we don't want to fill the filters too quickly, so we pull the carts two rows away from where the harvesters were operating. And as Peter showed, we have little battery-operated pumps that pull a vacuum, and it sucks the air. And using the aerodynamics of the filters, we collect different size fractions. In this case, we collected dust that had aerodynamic diameters less than 100 microns, and a respirable dust fraction, which is actually about PM4. So that's sort of what OSHA uses. It's a little different from 2.5 and 10. Anyway, it's respirable dust and total dust. Oh, I went the wrong way, my bad, sorry. First of all, I want you to know that the windrows that we sampled were essentially the same, either by the conventional or the modified, so there was no variation based on what's in the windrow. You see the data on the left show that the composition of the windrow is similar. But what is different is the amount of stuff that falls back to the orchard floor. And in the modified harvester, remember, there's the intention is to have more of that material not go through the fan. All right, you want to get all the nuts up, but you want more stuff to fall back to the orchard floor. And you see about twice as much material, or maybe 40% more in the modified, went back to the orchard floor and didn't get blown through the fan. And then when we measured the dust, we know the flow rates on those pumps. We know how much material is on the filters. We can calculate the milligrams per cubic meter of air that was generated by these two harvesters. The conventional on the top produced 10 times as much dust, roughly, as the modified total dust, and about 8 times as much or 7 times as much respirable dust as the modified. The conclusion is there are 800,000 acres of almonds harvested in California every year. And that's increased by about double in the last 10 years. And so I think if all harvests were done with modified harvesters, there would be a substantial decrease in the contribution of PM10 and respirable dust by almond harvest. So we were encouraged by that. Remember, the second most dusty operation in ag operations is land preparation, primarily to laser level the fields so that furrows can be created for irrigation. It's the next dustiest. So we did some experiments. Actually, we have a 15-year experiment going in the central part of the San Joaquin Valley, not focused specifically on dust, but that was part of what we were studying, a comparison of cotton and tomato rotation, the effects of conservation versus standard tillage, and what happens if we use cover crops and not in those operations. And the objective of the conservation tillage method was that we always plant the cotton and the tomatoes in the same beds. We never remake the beds. We never disc the beds. We never land level. So we remove a lot of those standard tillage types of operations. And a lot of other cool things that I can tell you about not related to dust with this experiment. But the point is, with the dust, I mean, it's not rocket science. I wish it were. But the reality is, from a conservation tillage point of view, how do you not make as much dust? Well, you don't drive your tractor across the field as much. And that's really what happens. And you're not doing the real dusty operations like land leveling, which is the real dusty operation. So you eliminate specific operations, and you just don't drive the tractor across the field as often. So there's standard tillage, no cover crop, standard tillage, cover crop, conservation tillage, no cover crop, and conservation tillage, cover crop. Notice that there's a variation in the number of field operations, but in general, conservation tillage cuts the field operations by about half. To plant a cover crop and harvest, it takes a few more operations, so that's why the variation there. But in general, the basic idea is that fewer passes across the field result in quite a bit less dust. So once again, the least dust was produced by the conservation tillage, no cover crop, about a third of the amount of dust produced by the standard tillage. Notice that the conservation tillage with cover crop was dustier. Well, more operations, and then you've got all that organic matter that you're kicking up into the atmosphere as dust. So the bottom line here, the take-home message, conservation tillage is another means by which agricultural dust can be reduced in row crop circumstances. So in the dustiest in the almond orchard and in the row crop production by eliminating some of those dusty land preparation operations. And just to show you that in the conservation tillage with cover crop, that some of the stuff you're breathing in that dust is pollen and who knows what else, fungal spores, valley fever, the list could go on and on, but I'll stop there because it's frightening enough just to think about what could be in that dust that we're breathing. And even with the conservation tillage with the cover crop, there could be some interesting health issues in terms of the kinds of materials that are produced by those cover crops. We did some other in the field dust measurements to assess the effects of water content and repetitive tillage, some work that Nick Madden did. And once again, I don't think it should surprise you that when I show you the results that the drier the soil is, the dustier it is, right? That makes perfectly good sense. And what we found is that, well, yeah, water content makes a big difference. It depends on the soil texture at which soils become dusty. And as the results will show, GWC refers to gravimetric water content. GWC1 is at about 15% mass water content. GWC4 is at 4% water content. And 2 and 3 are intermediate. So we wanted to see the effect of water content. And so D1 is disking once. We drove over the field one time and measured the dust, D2 the second time and the third time. A couple of things to note. At high water contents, with the black bar, essentially no dust emitted. But as you dry the soil out, even with one disking, water content affects the amount of dust produced. And if you drive over the field a second time, it produces more dust, and if you drive over it a third time, it produces even more dust. Because what we also measured, we found out that the aggregates were being pulverized, which is why we till, and as the aggregates became smaller, they became dustier. So once again, I think I don't know if this is intuitive, but I think it makes perfectly good sense. As a soil scientist, you'd say, well, the more you drive and beat the soil to a pulp, it's going to produce more dust, and if it's wet, it's not going to produce dust. So the bottom line is, with conservation tillage, there are fewer operations that are performed at low water content. So you can perform tillage operations at the higher water contents when less dust is produced. And because you don't do the repetitive disking, you eliminate that repetitive breaking down of soil aggregates to create more dust. So if it sounds like I'm on the soapbox for conservation tillage, well, I am. But as those of you who've done field work, and I just admire the work that Julie and all the others and Brent have done, you know, spending time out there in the field trying to get good data that makes sense. Sometimes it's very, very difficult because the wind's blowing the wrong way, or you pack your stuff and you go out in the desert and it rains that day, and that's the only day you can collect dust data, and you're just not going to get it. So we tussled with that, and a lot of the results were shown were from those field conditions, and we realized that could be pesky, so we decided to develop the dust generator. Peter showed this earlier. We call it Pigpen, and it's high-tech stuff. It's got a 40-gallon barrel and a 55-gallon barrel, and you put those together, and we tumble dust to simulate agricultural operations. It's not wind erosion. I'll emphasize that again. It's to simulate mechanical disturbance. And we wanted to be able to control what goes in the barrel on the left. That's the tumbling barrel, and control how soil properties might affect the amount of dust. There's the schematic. Don't need to show you that again, but the settling chamber is where we put the pumps, and we measure PM10, PM2.5, whatever we want to measure, in the same way that we've done all the other measurements. All right, the last couple of things to show you here. Equivalent gravimetric water content. So equivalent gravimetric water content equal to 1 is the mass water content at 15 bar, 15 kilopascals, permanent wilting point. And of course, as in some of the experiments data not shown, the drier things are, the more dust that's produced. But the question is, how do you use a similar or uniform concept of water content? And Ted, you said, well, I just use air dry. And we did that at first. And we said, but, you know, if you've ever taken a sample from a dry soil in a field, and it seems just drier than a bone, you know, drier than a wooden leg, and you put it in a plastic bag, moisture always condenses. And so the water content in field dry soils, even in the San Joaquin Valley, is much, much higher than air dry. And so what we wanted to do was try to simulate the water contents that would actually be the water content of soils when they were being disked in October. And the water content is much higher than air dry. So we went with this gravimetric water content. We took 1/3 of 15 bar water, and we equilibrated soils at that water content to do many of our studies. And we did that after we had done a bunch of laboratory studies, and we found out that there is clearly a threshold water content at which soils begin to emit dust, and the water content varies depending on texture. And so that's what's shown here. This is some of Nick Madden's work. PM10 concentrations increase as soils become drier, and I kind of eyeballed a threshold in here somewhere between 1 and 2 equivalent water contents. So, you know, maybe about 15 bar is where the permanent, where the sunflower dies, is where the dust is emitted. So the point is, texture makes a difference, water content makes a difference. Now, in spite of what Peter Narby told you earlier, before we had all of his data, we had actually a pretty good relationship between PM10 emission and sand or silt to clay ratios. But we had few data points. And some of the work we've done subsequent to the preparation of this slide has shown us that our silt-to-clay ratio is not a very good predictor in all cases. In particular, in sandy soils, it doesn't predict well. So Peter's work is a building on this work that we started with. And as you saw, his discussion has included other soil properties, that organic carbon, carbonate, diethinite extractable iron, and water-stable aggregates, to build on our model, because we recognized, even though it was published in a reputable journal, that it may not be completely right. Okay, so the summary, and I know that probably surprises you that I would say that, but we know that we're always looking forward. Okay, the summary, based on our work, modified almond harvesters reduced dust by 80-90% compared to conventional harvesters. Bottom line, if everybody harvested their almonds by modified harvester, probably we could cut into that PM10 emission. Similarly, conservation tillage can help reduce dust, and currently Row crop production in California employs conservation tillage only in about 2 to 3% of the cases. So there's, I think, a lot of room there in terms of dust to by conservation tillage. Soil dust production increases as soils become less aggregated by repetitive tilling, and especially at lower water contents. I have some nice data that show that. I think it makes sense. The silt to clay ratio at the time was the best predictor of dust production at the water contents below the dust production threshold, but we're working on a multiple regression approach to better predict from soil survey information where soils might be dusty. And I think an important message is that soil properties have to be taken into account when devising dust mitigation strategies. We all know that they don't emit dust at the same rate, and so we need to take those into consideration when emission factors are being developed. Thanks.